Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
I'm Michael Footer.
Each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros.
And we are delighted to be joined today by co-founder and CEO of Game Club, Dan Sherman. Dan is also a co-founder of Tilting Point, and he served as the director of business partnerships at EA Partners from 2003 to 2011. And for those of you who are as old as me, you may recall that that was the heyday of EA Partners, and there were a lot of amazing games that came out of that. In fact, I've been trying to get Amanda to sit down and play Syndicate with me because that game... That game was near and dear to my heart. Dan, how are you?
Great, and great to speak with you both. Appreciate you having me.
Oh, we're so glad to have you with us.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that that was an excellent segue for us to do what we always do with each of our guests, which is encourage you to talk about your origin story and your path into the game industry. It's a great way for our audience to get to know you as a human being as well as a professional. So Dan, dive in. What's your origin story? How did you get into games?
Great. So I guess it all started in the 80s. Growing up, I'm old enough to have been a proud owner of an Atari 2600. I think I got around my fifth birthday.
I'm so jealous.
Which I still remember very distinctly, my mom bringing that home. It blew my mind. So, you know, then, of course, grew up playing NES, and I have two younger brothers who are, they're twins, they're 7 years younger than me. So I think they kept me in gaming because I would always get them games for years and years. And I think between myself and them, we've owned every console, you know, under the sun. I got into the game industry about 17 years ago. So I've been in it a while. As you mentioned, EA is where I spent the first half of that career. What I joined EA, out of business school, and really, I bought an Xbox in business school because of my fascination with the industry and the business model. It was, you know, as a gamer at heart, that's always been part of me. But as kind of like a business person, so to speak, what really fascinated me, continues to fascinate me, is that here's this highly creative industry that has never stopped growing. And the reason it never stops growing is because the technology keeps making it better and better and better every year for consumers. And so, you know, I'm used to the old days where we had these hardware console cycles. So there would be fits and starts, but it would always be on an upward sloping trajectory. Mm-hmm. And also it's like, you know, of all businesses to work in or all industries to kind of devote your career, I just think games is a lot more interesting because every product is differentiated. There's no like commodities, right? Everything is creatively unique and artistic. So I think I've always been a business person that is drawn to artistic expression and also drawn to technology, and games for me is just this amazing marriage of both of those things. So I'd say the common theme in my 17 years of games is that I've always been on the sort of deal side or the business side, the partnerships side. EA Partners is my home at EAP, and as you pointed out, Mike, those really were some special years. I personally did the deal for Titanfall, and I was one of two guys that negotiated a Rock Band. You know, collectively, we're talking over $3 billion in revenue, just those two titles. So we made a splash during those years, and I think we also made a lot of developers very successful, which to me is personally fulfilling for everything I've done. Yeah,
absolutely. EA Partners. Yeah. No, EA Partners was always something that was so interesting to me because it leveraged EA's publishing know-how, all of those operations that were kind of there and had those fixed costs associated with them on an, from an internal perspective, and not only helped put to use those processes and policies that were in place, but as you said, also lifted up a number of developers.
Yeah, that was actually the, you know, having a kind of a service oriented developer facing business unit at EA was what made that so successful. Other publishers didn't really have that. They might have had a biz dev person, right, or a lawyer negotiating those deals, but we had an entire team to support developers. And so that became the inspiration for my first startup in mobile games, which is Tilting Point, sort of drawing the inspiration, like what happens in a world where, you know, so much of what we were selling at EA Partners was EA's packaged goods retail distribution network, right, which was the best in the world at that time. And to me, it's like, what happens when that no longer is a competitive advantage because everything's digital? And that became Tilting Point. What are all the value-added services that a publisher can provide to developers that developers lack because they don't have the scale of a global publisher? And so I poured that into the Tilting Point, which I ran for about 7 years. And today it's doing very well. That ultimately led to a new inspiration, which has become GameFund.
I love that Tilting Point was like the first expression of what, like in my mind anyway, when I think about Tilting Point, and I've had a number of conversations with folks over at Tilting Point over the years. And I love that business model. I think it's really interesting. And I think that the way that the folks over at Tilting Point handle things is exceptional. But I want to know, like, how did you dig into Game Club and say, this is what I want to do?
Yeah. So if you've followed, you know, Tilting Point from the beginning, but if you remember, we began by producing and funding and marketing and publishing original IPs. And the very first game was a premium game editor's choice winner called Leo's Fortune.
I think I saw that at GDC 2014.
Yeah, exactly. It launched in, you would have, because it launched like a month later in April of 2014, I believe. So very successful game. And also what I would consider it a true classic of iOS. It won an Apple Design Award, it made a lot of money. And, you know, for the three guys in Gothenburg, Sweden that made it, it made them, very successful financially as well as critically. So to me, that was one of the most satisfying things. And to have that be Tilting Point's first game was really special. It put us on the map. Over and over again, actually, Tilting Point has proven to make developers very successful financially. The common theme in all of my game companies that I've been involved with is we derive our success only from the success of the developers that we partner. So that to this day remains a staple at Tilting Point, certainly embedded in Game Club. But the inspiration for Game Club came out of starting from that place of premium gaming. I think, releasing an editor's choice premium game, $4.99 price point in 2014 was sort of like getting the last ticket to Disney World before it burned down, because everything was heavily going to free to play at that point. So Tilting Point naturally pivoted to free to play, and it took a lot of investment in tools and technology to really support developers with best in class user acquisition and value added publishing services. Certainly the relationship with the platforms helped. But that became a formula for success at Tilting Point under the freemium model. So I am somebody that came from AAA console with success and then learned through blood, sweat, and tears the freemium model, ultimately finding success with that as well. Game Club was born out of my observation of what had become of mobile gaming as a result of the huge economic force that is freemium gaming. So, we're talking about $100 billion in consumer spend that now is through in-app purchases of freemium games. What I have learned about that model is that success in freemium, there's a rule book and a playbook for it. That playbook dictates, for the most part, that you cannot design your games to be completed. Games cannot be completed. They have to be infinitely playable, and they have to facilitate infinite amount of spending. That's how the freemium model works. It's on mm-hmm. a perpetual retention loop built around mm-hmm. Core loops or compulsion loops and restriction mechanics, which are truthfully derived from the casino industry. I think most people who have mastered free-to-play acknowledge that. But it means that there's a lot of categories of games for which it does not work. The business model doesn't work. So games that can be completed, for the most part, games for kids are not a fit for freemium because you monetize freemium games through what we call whales, people that will spend $10,000 as an individual in your game or more. And kids don't have credit cards. They can't get away with that type of spending. my daughter has definitely attempted that in Roblox. Other categories that are just sort of like left behind are largely skill-based games. So we did a study at Tilting Point that was like looking at how many of the top grossing titles on the App Store were actually skill-based. Overwhelmingly, they were not. They were based on the illusion of skill. Monetizing, basically, your progress was gated by the time you spent or the money you spent in the game, not by your skill level. So Game Club was born out of the categories that were left behind by freemium, especially as that 99 cent to 4.99 or what have you upfront premium price point has disappeared. It's gone the way of the 99 cent song, if you will. So developers no longer able to monetize through that paid upfront price model and not making the type of game that is served well by free to play, what's become of those developers? They've left mobile. They've gone to platforms like Steam, Nintendo Switch, or they've left the industry. And to me, that was an industry problem worth solving. So Game Club, I spent a lot of time in the industry. I've worked, in my youth in the music industry as a member of the Producers Guild. So I pay attention to sort of TV film. And I think, similar to you, Mike, I've studied the impact that subscription has had on other entertainment businesses. And the impact that it's had is that it's literally revolutionized the business model of those industries, giving rise to companies like Netflix and Spotify. So my idea, starting about 3 years ago, was to use the subscription business model to revive premium gaming on mobile, mm-hmm. Not in competition to the freemium model, but to rise up alongside it as a better way for developers to make money and with premium games, which is to say, not built around compulsion loops or restriction mechanics or perpetual retention, but just pure entertainment, deliver pure entertainment, in the way that HBO does, right? And that's how Game Club was born.
And you're focused on mobile still. I know you launched on iOS, mm-hmm. and I believe we got a press release not too long ago that you've expanded to Android since then, correct?
Yeah, we launched on Android about 2 weeks ago, so Google Play. So we have become the only cross-platform premium mobile game subscription service. So we launched on iOS in October. And in fact, we launched before Apple Arcade, if you count our soft launch. But we launched sort of in between Apple Arcade and Google Play Pass last fall. And effective June of this year, we are cross-platform, truly cross-platform, which means one subscription gets you unlimited access to all of our games on both Google Play and iOS.
That's great. Just as a point of curiosity, and I don't know if you're able to talk about this, given that those are tied to the devices we carry in our pockets and most people only have one, do you see a lot of people who are taking advantage of the titles on both of those platforms?
Yeah, we see it in the form of families, and we see
Ah,
it
okay.
in the form of like kind of the more international audience. So the idea is that Game Club it can and should be shared with your family if you're like
Awesome.
of that age, like I am. We did a little bit of a press push in April when we announced that our family sharing plan supports up to 12 family members.
Oh, that's great.
And which during coronavirus was actually a really great thing to have, especially if you're like me and you've got kids cooped up in the house with not enough to do, and if you also
Oh,
kind of,
definitely.
yeah, like for me, my skin crawls when my kids are exposed to these ads that are in the premium games and when they get prompted
Yes.
for in-app purchases. So I just personally hate that. Plus, we go on, when we do travel, by car or airplane. Game Club is fully playable offline, so it's like the perfect thing. You've got multiple iPads, and what I know, I have a lot of friends internationally. The parents might have an iOS device, but they probably have a cheaper Android device for their kids, and that is proving to be the case where families are really taking advantage of Game Club's family sharing. Because it not only gives them access to up to 12 devices, but those devices can be any device on Android or iOS.
Oh, that's excellent. You brought it up, and we talked a little bit about this in the pre-show, but I wrote a piece for my monthly column at Variety Gaming, rest in peace, before that went away, called The Future of Gaming is Subscription. And one of the things that has interested me is that consumers on the whole have moved towards adoption very easily, or at least with less friction, when it comes to music, when it comes to video entertainment, whether that's television shows or movies. Gamers and game purchasers, especially on PC and console, seem to have held on to the idea of ownership, whether that's the physical disc in their hands or a digital license that they purchase from one of the many storefronts. Why do you think that it took so long for consumer sentiment around content ownership to start shifting positively towards subscription for video games?
Sure. I will try to keep that answer that briefly, but this is exactly what my brain has been obsessed with for the last 3 years. And the console world is so different from mobile. But let's talk broadly about games. I would say coming from EA, coming from the business side of EA in particular, knowing what those P&Ls look like, knowing the investment that goes into making these AAA games, which are amazing, right? The prevalent business model there. Subscription, moving from a subscription model, whether you're Adobe or your Microsoft Office or any number of companies that have made that transition, they go through something that in subscription nerd speak is called the fish model, which if you look that up, it's literally the model that looks like a fish. Your costs go way up because you've got to support CRM and direct to consumer, like all this type of technology to manage a subscription effectively. And your revenue goes way down actually for a period of time until the other side of that fish, you circle back up again. And all of a sudden, once you reach a certain scale, the revenue becomes astronomical. Look at Netflix, for example. And your costs on a marginal basis become lower because you've got so many users, that infrastructure that you've built technologically scales quite well. So, like if you used to sell Microsoft Office by the box, and now you're instead selling it to people for a $5 a month subscription, for example, or Adobe Creative Suite or whatever you what have you. There's a near-term hit with that transition. And when you talk about the price point of console games, that is a major hit. Transitioning to subscription, providing overwhelming value to consumers, I benefited from EA Access and Xbox Game Pass, PlayStation Now. It does have the potential of cannibalizing the pre-existing consoles sales. And and most game companies cannot handle that right now. They can't take that hit right now. That would be a sort of dropping a bomb on their P&L for a couple of years until you come out on the other side of that fish model and this and the revenue curve offsets all that costs. You know, I frequently say that Netflix wasn't built in a day, right? They didn't have to sacrifice some pre-existing revenue stream. I mean, Disney Plus is a good example. I mean, before coronavirus, think about like what kind of near-term sacrifice they're making to box office by making all of these movies available day and date with theatrical exhibition. Like that is a transition that is not easy to pull off. And that's why the companies that you are seeing investing heavily in subscription are trillion-dollar corporations that can, that not only can handle that economic near-term hit, but also have the data and the insights into consumer behavior to know how massive the opportunity is when you come out on the other side of that. Yeah, there are companies that cannot afford to take that hit near-term. But the companies that you do see investing so heavily in subscription right now are trillion-dollar corporations that can pull it off. You know, Apple, Google, Microsoft, Amazon. You know, so these are companies that can afford to make that investment near-term, and there are also companies that have the user data and insights into consumer trends to know how massive the subscription opportunity is when you come out the other side of that, when you have real scale with your subscribers, and you know how powerful that can be. I mean, looking at Netflix as an example, like it's leapfrogged all of the incumbent movie studios through the power of subscription at scale. So that's just a more difficult transition for the game industry to go through, largely because of the console price point. So if you take that over to mobile and premium games, our fish model looks different because premium games have already basically been nuked by consumer migration towards getting games for free. And just that general consumer trend away from purchasing and owning digital content, which on mobile has really taken over. So premium games, you know, that inspiration for a game club, there's not a lot of near-term revenue to sacrifice. And that's why Game Club has been able to move in as a startup and aggregate, you know, over 120 really high quality games without spending $500 million.
That's great.
You said Netflix wasn't built in a day or in an afternoon or over the course of even just a couple of months. It was years and years and years of continued evolution. So let's keep talking about that though. There are so many different subscriptions that you can subscribe to these days, right? More even just software aside or movie and television streaming aside, you know, we've got PlayStation Now and Xbox Game Pass and EA Access and Uplay Plus and Origin Access. And over on mobile, there's Apple Arcade and Google Play Pass and, of course, Game Club. So what are going to be the hallmarks of a successful subscription as the market continues to become more and more crowded?
Sure. So again, something I've studied pretty intimately. So part of the reason why myself and my co-founder Oliver moved in and decided to do Game Club is we were aware of a lot of these other offerings. And as regards mobile, I didn't believe that anybody was really doing it right. And part of that is that a lot of these companies were doing it through streaming technology, which definitely has had its share of hiccups in the console world. By comparison, you know, Xbox Game Pass has like something like 10 times the number of subscribers as PlayStation Now, because Xbox Game Pass has embraced downloads, whereas PlayStation was sort of like married to subscription with PlayStation Now at the beginning.
Got it.
In fact, PlayStation Now really didn't start growing its subscriber base until it started offering downloads as an option. Stadia has definitely had a tough debut, in part because of the challenges of that streaming technology. Also much more expensive to do than downloads. But the other companies that were doing it in mobile were all streaming based. And so there's a couple of things there. I would say quantitatively, if you divide the world of game subscriptions across all platforms into two buckets, one being download based and one being streaming based, it's easy to quantify that there's at least more than 10 times as many subscribers in the download world between Xbox Game Pass, EA Access, and Nintendo Switch Online. That's something like 30 million mm-hmm. subscribers right there. That doesn't even count Apple Arcade or Google Play Pass or any of the others. Combine all the subscribers that we know about across Stadia, PlayStation Now, you know, and others, it's less than 3 million. So what I do know as a, you know, industry participant here, is that subscribers are migrating towards the download-based solutions much, much more so than they are the streaming-based ones. Now, you could argue that in a few years that may look different on console, and I wouldn't disagree with you. But on mobile, I just don't see the technology catching up with, you know, Game Club is available on 3 billion devices now, actually more than any of those, all of those other ones combined. You know, the idea of having a game play seamlessly on cloud, you know, no matter where you are in the world, doesn't seem like a near-term improvement to the user experience, right? And when I look at Netflix and Spotify and what made them successful, the number one thing is they made the user experience better, right? So games are not streaming media files. They are interactive software products where latency really matters, connectivity. You know, a premium game should feel like it's on your device. And so that's a part of what makes Game Club unique amongst all these other mobile subscription offerings, all of which are only on Android, by the way, because Apple's guidelines do not allow subscription-based multi-game services on iOS. So we look for inspiration to things like Xbox Game Pass. I think Xbox Game Pass is the gold standard for multi-game subscription on console. It's successful. People like it. It's doing very well. In my view, nobody's besides Game Club is really providing the right service, both from a consumer perspective, but also from a developer perspective on mobile. So, you know, we built this with the inspiration to make the best game developers money by having them participate in the upside from our subscription revenue-wise. And in doing so, bring developers, premium game developers, back to mobile to the, you know,
So I just want to drill down on that a little bit. There's two aspects, especially now on the Apple Arcade, Google Play Pass, and of course the Game Club side of this. One is, you know, we've had differing kind of feedback on mobile usage during the pandemic. I know that Quibi was one that kind of blamed the pandemic for its problems because it was mobile only. And you know, we've seen that Apple Arcade recently has been doing some shifting in order to retain people. My question for you is has the pandemic been good for mobile gaming and for those people who are engaged with it, and you know, for you and for the competitors in that space, or has it actually been more challenging as people are not out and about or commuting, or you know, using their phone as a primary communication device when they have their computers or their consoles right there?
So from the Game Club perspective, I would say the pandemic has been neutral to positive. We were growing double digits every month before the pandemic, and we've continued to grow double digits every month since the pandemic. So okay. The reason I say it's a net positive is because that press I mentioned around family sharing that we did in April immediately increased our users like 20%. Hmm. And so that said to me that having a premium mobile game subscription for every device in your household is something that makes the life during home sheltering better. You know, so I think we benefited from that. I don't know many game companies that have been hurt by the pandemic. I think the more social you're offering, the more upside there has been. But, you know, premium mobile games, I think we do have now some pretty awesome multiplayer games, but we didn't, you know, at that time. It was mostly single player experiences. And from that standpoint, it's just really about like, I'm bored. I don't have enough to do. I've already gotten through everything I want to watch on Netflix. here's this wealth of hundreds of hours of games in the palm of my hand. And, you know, my kid or my spouse or whoever can also play on their own device in their own room under a single, very inexpensive, you know, monthly subscription. So from that standpoint, we're I would say at minimum unharmed by the pandemic, and, you know, possibly have benefited, not tremendously, but, you know, because I think we're already something new. And I think as a startup, you know, our biggest challenge is just to spread the word about Game Club so that more people know about it and know what it is. But I think those that do would accept that it's a nice thing to have around if you're stuck. You know, I look at mobile gaming as something that people do on the go. But for me, I think once you get past the point of being able to sit down in your living room and monopolize your TV for like 4 straight hours, which I haven't been able to do in over a decade, you know, in my house, playing in your bed, on your phone, or, you know, on the couch, you know, in another room or something, or just hanging out, you know, that's the way I think most people play mobile games. And you don't have to be on the go to enjoy that experience.
Great. The other thing, the other piece of that is the compensation side for the developers that you're working with. Now, I think you said you pay them on the front end as opposed to the back end, correct?
No. We do both.
Okay.
Okay. That's something that's pretty unique and very important about Game Club is that, you know, I'm not aware of any other game subscription offering that actually shares revenue with developers in a totally transparent way, but we do. Mm. And that is a very important part of our business model and the inspiration for our business model from the beginning. So half of our revenue goes right back to the content creators. Game Club actually takes over development. So participation in Game Club for game makers is totally effortless. They never have to do anything. We take over the source code, you know, with their permission, and we actually do the game updates and maintenance. And in fact, you know, 10 of our Android launch titles had never been on Android before, so we actually did the port ourselves at our own expense. And so then we, half of the money that we collect from the App Store goes back to the game creators without any deductions every month. So they're actually making, for the most part, significantly more money than they were before, because a lot of these games, as you might know, had actually been removed from the App Store for lack of 64-bit support.
Sure.
It wasn't economic for the developers to continue supporting these games, but it is economical for us to do that. So everybody else, to my knowledge, is basically writing large upfront checks, but they're not sharing any upside with the developers. If they are, it's a very low ceiling that's capped at some arbitrary number that some executives set. It's what I think in Netflix, you know, speak what they would call a back-end buyout. We don't do that. I've always, you know, been a strong proponent of, you know, make sure that the costs of the talented people you work with are covered so that they don't ever lose money. but then offer them the upside when they make something great. You know, when they, you know, I think talented people, whether you're a baseball player or an artist or a game developer or a movie producer, like, you want to participate in that upside. If you don't participate in the upside, what's your motivation to make something great as opposed to just making something done, right? Mm-hmm. And so me, having been 17 years in the business of striking partnerships with developers, you know, I want them to have that motivation. So Game Club was literally built around making developers money on the upside.
So that's really interesting. So it's one part. So it seems like there's elements of a publishing arrangement in here, but there's also elements of a co-op arrangement. This is really fascinating. Like, I was not aware of the revenue structure, so I'm glad we kind of jumped into that.
Yeah, we're
you're right. It is unique.
Yeah, we're a developer, and we are, in a manner of speaking, a publisher, but really we are a service. You know, we're a service to developers, and we're a service to gamers. So, you know, we give game developers the opportunity to let us take over the development of the game for their benefit at no cost to them, and actually, you know, providing more a better, more scalable revenue stream for them than previously was available.
Neat.
I think that's gorgeous. I love that. And I am all about transparency in business models. It's something Mike and I talk about constantly. Especially on Virtual Economy, is making sure that creatives, developers, the people that are out there that are making the games, that they are the first stop in being taken care of with not just subscription models, but publishing arrangements and agreements and stuff like that. So that's fantastic. I want to talk a little bit more about subscriptions and game ownership, because I know that we had this conversation, gosh, we've been having this conversation around music, around television, and around movies for so many years, and we're just starting to have that conversation with the general public these days. So from your perspective, you know, what's the relationship between subscriptions and game ownership? You know, is this a zero sum game? Can this be symbiotic?
It can. And so while at Tilting Point, I signed a couple of games to subscription platforms like PlayStation Now is an example. It was one of them. And one of the things that gave me a lot of confidence in the future of subscription is that here was a game, and this was Leo's Fortune again, that was available for download on PlayStation. And it was also available as part of PlayStation Now. And two things really struck me from that experience. It was, number one, there was zero cannibalization of the paid sales of the game, even when the subscription version of it was generating 12 times more revenue than the paid version. So all of a sudden, it was just pure incremental revenue with zero cannibalization. And that, to me, was really exciting. And I do hear that time and time again, that subscription does not tend to cannibalize pre-existing console sales. And I think that may actually be the case with Xbox Game Pass. I'm not 100% sure, but it does seem like it. Anecdotally, I've been hearing that. The other thing that struck me about PlayStation Now was that it was very noticeably a better experience when I downloaded it versus playing it on that cloud-based service. And you know, right. I don't mean to knock Sony, but I think generally speaking, you know, even Google with their investment in Stadia, like that's visibly present. You know, there is a noticeable difference, and that to me clearly spelled out, okay, subscription is a great business model. Streaming is what I'm wary about, and a lot of people tend to refer to them synonymously, subscription and streaming, because they are the same thing in TV and music, but they're totally different things in games.
Right.
Subscription, the business model, is what to me has tons of merit. Streaming, TBD. So listen, this is a transition that is coming, that has happened in every entertainment medium already. It took a while, but it did in fact become a game changer as a business model in and TV, music, you know, a whole bunch of other entertainment verticals. It's coming late to games because, as I mentioned earlier, with that console price point, very difficult for publishers, especially Take-Two, for example, to embrace that near-term hit that they would get.
We'll talk about Take-Two.
We're getting there.
GTA, you know, it's $1 billion you make in your first weekend when you launch a new GTA. You're not going to get that with subscription if it's, you know, $5 a month, right? It's impossible to pull that off. So that illustrates why it's coming later on console. It's also such a huge industry, right? That in terms of revenue, that that transition is naturally going to have to happen more slowly. And then in mobile, you've got free to play. So, you know, Supercell is not going to be switching to a subscription model anytime soon because they're doing extremely well through in-app purchases. Other companies, you know, Vudu, Ketchup, you know, that are doing hyper casual are making tons of money through ads. So you have to look at the transition to subscription-based gaming on mobile through the lens of primarily premium games, because that's where there's an undeniable benefit, both from a game developer's standpoint, but also the consumer standpoint of, you know, people that love premium games and seeing them disappearing from the App Store, seeing the App Store just become this homogeneous kind of like mix of constant reskins of the same five genres. You know, it's like the free-to-play model only supporting like five, you know, or six different genres, you know, or gameplay mechanics. You know, it's made, you know, if you remember the App Store's like 10 years ago, like I do, it was this incredible explosion of creativity and, you know, all kinds of innovation and gameplay. That's no longer the case. You know, people are going with what works under that sort of retention loop basis, premium model. You know, the costs are so high that you have to go with what works. So yeah, so this is part of the reason why you see subscription coming later as a dominant model in games.
Gotcha. So we were talking a little bit about Take-Two, and I promised we would get back there. One of the things that was really interesting to us is video game prices on console. You're talking about full price premium games haven't gone up since 2005, the advent of the Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3 console cycle, and games jumped from 50 to 60, and people were pretty okay with it. Of course, there was the usual amount of grousing, but price sensitivity, you know, is a little softer around new console launches. 2K announced that NBA 2K21, if you purchase the next gen version, is going to be $70, which is the canary in the coal mine, as we said. For what we expect to see
so many Kirby's.
Yes. We expect to see that a number of publishers are going to follow suit. But what's very interesting about this for us is that this also comes at the same time as smart delivery on Xbox One and Xbox Series X. And, you know, Sony hasn't named it, but there is some sort of similar upgrade path. Cyberpunk's going to be using it. We know a number of games are going to be using smart delivery to smooth the upgrade process from one generation to the next. With all of those new moving pieces, how does that impact the selling and value proposition for subscriptions? And how does that change the calculus around how you promote and how you talk about Game Club and other subscription services, of course?
Right. So, I mean, Game Club is sort of happily mobile specific right now. I think our vision is certainly to be on all platforms, PC, console, everything. But we're starting with the largest segment of the game world, which is mobile by revenue. And also the one where I think there's the least amount of competition. The economics for rolling out subscription on mobile are quite different from console. But I, you know, coming from EA, and I was at EA when that Xbox 360 console transition happened. You know, price went from 50 to 60, but the development costs went up 4x right? And and you know, I spent many years at EA after that, and my observation, development costs for AAA console games increased on average by about 10% a year. So extrapolate that to 2020, and you're talking, it's about $100 million to make a AAA console game. And that's been validated by, you know, some friends of mine that, that work in that, in that part of the industry. So I think, you know, Strauss Zelnick has been sort of like vocally opposed to subscription in console, and I understand why, because of where he is in that fish model, right? There would be way too much of a near-term sacrifice from the packaged goods retail revenue standpoint for Take-Two to make that transition anytime soon, unless, you know, somebody like Google or Microsoft were to plunk down $1 billion, you know.
Sure.
That's not going to happen, right? So number one, it makes sense that they would be raising price because their costs, you know, I don't think that the population of console gamers has increased that much, frankly, since I worked at EA, which, you know, we're talking almost 10 years ago. But development costs have gotten, you know, multiples higher. So makes sense that the price would go up. But it also makes sense just from the standpoint of consumer trends generally, and from the standpoint of consumer value proposition, that services like Xbox Game Pass, EA Access, and the like would become more and more popular over time. Like, so my exposure to console has been fairly limited. You know, in fact, lately it's just been playing the Plants vs. Zombies Garden Warfare games with my 5-year-old son.
Good choices.
Yeah, which are great, perfect for him and for me. But do I want to pay, you know, $120 to download like the 4 PVZ console games just to show them to my son, or pay $5 a month with EA Access and get all of them, you know, under that plan? Like, from a consumer standpoint, that is a certified no-brainer. Right. So the value proposition that subscription is delivering to gamers is off the charts. It's the economics to publishers that you have to be sensitive to when you think about how long is it going to take for this transition to roll out. And again, back to the Netflix wasn't built in a day. When they started streaming movies in 2007, they were not the blockbuster, you know, AAA films that, you know, they were blurry B and C movies that you never heard of. But
or in Canada, they were documentaries because I lived back in Canada, it came to us in like 2010, and it was mostly documentaries.
Yeah. So I would say Game Club is, you know, in stark contrast to Apple Arcade, by the way. I think Apple Arcade is trying to build Netflix in a day, right? And I think they're finding that that is not the most economical way to go about it, let alone, you know, that I think they made $500 million in investments before they even knew what consumers are going to want to play through a subscription, right? We've taken a much more humble approach. So we now know exactly what types of games people want to consume through a multi-game subscription, but we're taking more of that Netflix approach, which is we're starting with stuff that, in our case, we have a high quality bar. So I'd say we try to have like an HBO level quality bar, but without question, you know, our stuff is characterized by classics of the last 10 years, not brand new productions, right? So we're going with like classic premium gameplay that we've been able to, for which we've been able to get the rights inexpensively against the promise of the revenue share, which is actually paying out nicely to some of these developers now. But, you know, where the undeniable impact of subscription really plays out is when those subscriber numbers get to scale. When you get to a large scale, like Netflix has. You literally become the dominant provider of the best content because they can afford to do that. That the Netflix subscription model has now has resulted in Netflix having more purchasing power for the best films. So they outbid Paramount, you know, or Warner Brothers or the like. And, you know, I remember reading The Hollywood Reporter, and you were writing for Variety. So, like, I remember reading The Hollywood Reporter like 5 years ago, like, Paramount did this deal, Warner did this deal, you know. Now it's Netflix did this deal, Apple did this deal, and Amazon did this deal. Like,
true. You know,
though it's the subscription model that has, in fact, created better economics for content creators and has delivered better, a better value proposition to consumers. It takes a while for that transition to play out, but once it does, it's better for everybody.
Wow. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to watch how this arc continues. And in fact, that brings us to our last question, is what do you think the next 5 years are going to look like in the way we consume games from an ownership, rental, subscription perspective? Do you think the subscription arc is going to continue up and take over some of the ownership conversation? Or do you see the audience growing in such a way that there is room for both of those, or just interested in your perspective and how you are looking down the road?
Sure. So if the five-year perspective for me, what we're going to see is subscription continuing to grow rapidly, not replacing console game purchases, just like it, but growing up alongside it. Just like in mobile, free-to-play in-app purchases are not going away anytime soon. They're going to continue to grow. In-game advertising in mobile is going to continue to grow. And subscription is going to grow up right alongside it. So it's going to be it's a new business model that is disruptive, and it's going to be very appealing to a lot of people, especially people that consume a lot of games, which historically, there's a sort of like a relatively small percentage of the overall console gaming market that spends a disproportionate amount of money on console games. So those, they represent a large percentage of the revenue. And those people are without question going to be benefiting from these subscription services. So what I also believe is happening, which is really exciting to me, is there's sort of like a convergence of operating systems happening, you know, with sort of Apple moving into the living room, Google moving into the living room, you know, already having, you know, billions of people playing games on their devices, which keep getting more and more more powerful every year. And again, I was always inspired originally by this industry, by the technological improvements, you know, the amount of power that is in a smartphone and how seamlessly it's connected to your TV. I think we'll see more and more lines being blurred between where the game is running. Is it running on your phone? Is it running on your a huge box that's connected to your TV through an HDMI cable? Is it running in the cloud? Or is there some combination of all this stuff going on? And then from a business model perspective, I look at subscription as the great unifier of console and mobile games, because historically, it's been two fundamentally different business models. Like console, you paid $60 for a game. Mobile, you got for free to download, and you monetize through these crazy loopy, you know, in-app purchase structure, which has not really made its way to console in force, just like the console monetization model hasn't made its way to mobile. But now you've got subscription growing up alongside both verticals. So with business models converging, between console and mobile via subscription, and the operating systems converging through technology, I think 5 years from now, there could be sort of one giant Netflix for games, right? Certainly Game Club's hat is in that arena. There are more than, $1 trillion or $1 billion companies that whose hats are also in that arena. So we're definitely ambitious. And I think we've hit a couple of key milestones that nobody else has. But yeah, I think the future, I think subscription is an undeniable part of our future. Game ownership will still be there too. But, I think consumer trends in general are migrating slowly but surely away from purchasing and owning a piece of digital content to effectively purchasing access to a large library of content. So I do believe that that is the larger trend that we'll see over time.
Excellent.
Okay. All right. Well, Dan, thank you so much for joining us today and for this incredible conversation. We definitely will want to have you back when we start having more conversations about game pricing and subscriptions. And Mike and I are so passionate about this topic. So now we know. Yeah. Now we know you can come back and hang out with us and get really nerdy about it with us.
Yeah, you can count on that. I'm extremely passionate about this, and I spent a lot of sleepless nights trying to figure this out. So it's a pleasure speaking to both of you, Mike and Amanda. Thanks for having me on, and happy to come back anytime.
Excellent. Thanks.
Excellent. Well, we also want indies to come on and chat with us. We haven't had an indie spotlight in like a month. It's been like 2 months.
I mean, we've had guests who represented their own projects.
It's true, but we haven't had like projects to come on and give us little, like 3 to 5 minute spots about their games. So this is our regular shout out and our call to indies. If you have a game that has a vertical slice, if you've recently released a game, if you're seeking funding, if you are like, hey, I made this really cool thing and I want to tell the world about it. Okay, well, virtual economy is not the world, but you know what we mean. We want to hear from you. So get in touch with us. We are at Virtual Econcast on Twitter. Our DMs are open. Or you can send us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz. And this has been episode 30 of the Virtual Economy Podcast. We did it. We did 30 episodes. Well, this is technically 31 episodes, but that's zero with array. Why did we do that? We screwed ourselves.
It's my favorite.
It's so bad. It's so bad. I blame us from back in March. Yeah. But thank you so much for listening to the Virtual Economy Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Virtual Econcast. I am at Amanda Farrow.
And I'm at Footerish, F-U-T-T-E-R-I-S-H. Hey, Dan, where can people find you online?
They can find me mostly on LinkedIn. I don't have a big Twitter presence, but I definitely...
You are smarter than us.
I definitely encourage any game developers interested in Game Club to hit me up at LinkedIn. And any consumers interested in a mobile premium subscription service that's growing with new games every week should visit gameclub.io or just search Game Club on the App Store or Google Play.
Awesome. And if you are listening to Virtual Economy for the first time, we encourage you to subscribe to our RSS feed at virtualeconomy.libsyn, that's libsyn.com/RSS. You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and a bunch more. And if possible, we'd love it if you reviewed the show. We'd love to know what you think, especially if you have nice things to say.
Yes, we like hearing nice things. But if you have actual feedback or questions, you can also do that too. And you can get in touch with us either by DM at Virtual Econcast or send us an email to podcast@fsquared.biz. Speaking of F Squared, Virtual Economy is an F Squared initiative. And along with pro bono business consulting for up and coming developers, it's a way that we are working to give back to the community because it has already given us so much. To find out more about F Squared and the services we can provide, including pitch prep, media training, mock reviews, and business strategy guidance, visit our website at fsquared.biz.
And we will be back later this week for our weekly news show. And in the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another. We'll see you soon.